Today, Parliament reconvenes after a historic ruling in the Supreme Court, and why we need to resist this new era of capitalism.
Hello?
Peter Walker, The Guardian's political correspondent. We're in the midst of constitutional history being made in the UK, and yet Prime Minister Boris Johnson is in New York. You're there with him.
It has been chaos. I mean, it's been chaos for me. It's been much so, more so for him.
Chaos is one way of describing the fallout from yesterday's historic decision in the Supreme Court. As Boris Johnson was waking up in New York ahead of a day at the UN, in London, Lady Hale calmly delivered a verdict that deals a huge blow to his government and his leadership.
The court is bound to conclude, therefore, that the decision to advise Her Majesty to prorogue Parliament was unlawful because it had the effect of frustrating or preventing the ability of Parliament to carry out its constitutional functions without reasonable justification.
We actually don't know exactly where Boris Johnson was when he heard the news. We think he was in his hotel room. None of his people were with him at the time. It's very, very much not the verdict that the Number 10 staff were hoping they would get.
Today, after weeks of political paralysis, MPs will return to Parliament and resume the debate on Brexit. And for Boris Johnson, he now faces calls to stand down.
And I invite Boris Johnson, in the historic words, to consider his position.
It's going to be very, very difficult. It's going to go into a very, very hostile Parliament. These are not normal political times. You know, with most other prime ministers in the past, this would be seen as a fatal blow. With Boris Johnson amidst the chaos of Brexit, you really, really can't tell.
From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, constitutional chaos, how the Supreme Court overruled Boris Johnson.
So prorogation essentially is a way of stopping Parliament from meeting.
Philippe Sands is a QC and a professor of law at University College London.
It happens from time to time. There's nothing abnormal or strange about prorogation. What was curious here was that the prorogation was for an extended period of time, and it was extended right up until the middle of October. And of course, immediately people said he's extended it to avoid debate or, worse, decisions being taken by Parliament, which could hamper, as it then was his rush to a no-deal Brexit, as things seemed. So he goes up to advise the Queen on the need for a prorogation longer than normal. And the important point to note is that the Queen really doesn't have a discretion. The system is premised on a Prime Minister advising the Queen honestly, lawfully, candidly, giving the proper reasons. And she then basically rubber stamps it. And it effectively had the consequence that Parliament would be silenced in the crucial period in the run-up to that European Council meeting.
At the time, Boris Johnson argued that prorogation wasn't politically motivated and was in fact just procedure.
If you look at what we're doing, we're bringing forward a new legislative programme on crime, on hospitals, and making sure that we have the education funding that we need.
There was a lot of political opposition to this decision, wasn't there, at the time?
There was a huge amount of political opposition. All of the opposition parties, Labour, Lib Dem, Scottish Nationalists, Plaid Cymru, Caroline Lucas for the Greens and others, immediately, I mean, within milliseconds, were saying this is unparalleled, it hasn't happened before in this way, it's totally new, it's totally political, you are trying to silence us.
Suspending Parliament is not acceptable, it's not on. What the Prime Minister is doing is a sort of smash and grab on our democracy.
Some Conservative MPs took the same view and were extremely vocal in opposing it. People who are respected, not seen as outliers, people like Dominic Grieve.
The intention wasn't just a reset with a Queen's speech. The intention was to try to make sure Parliament wasn't sitting at an inconvenient time for the government.
But it wasn't just MPs that disagreed with Boris Johnson. On the day Parliament was suspended, I went to cover the protest in Westminster, and there was a lot of anger and upset. People staged a sit-in as it got dark and shouted, "If you shut down our Parliament, we'll shut down the street."
Stop the coup! Stop the coup! Stop the coup!
Several legal challenges were launched immediately. In England, judges decided that it was not an issue for the courts to interfere in.
The High Court has rejected a legal challenge to Mr Johnson's decision to suspend Parliament. The case was brought by the businesswoman Gina Miller.
But in Scotland, prorogation was ruled to be unlawful.
Three senior judges at Scotland's highest civil court ruled the Prime Minister illegally suspended Parliament.
The government challenged that decision, and consequently the case ended up before 11 judges at the Supreme Court, the UK's final court of appeal.
The 11 judges of the Supreme Court, essentially, the nub of it was to deal with a couple of appeals. They were facing an appeal from the government on the decision of the Scottish Court to say the Scottish Court had got it wrong, and an appeal from the London Court, from Gina Miller and others, to say that the London Court had got it wrong. So it was at least a double appeal. Basically, what the Supreme Court did was that it took all of the issues that arose and reduced them to their essence. It's sort of like making a really good sauce. You bung it all in, all the ingredients, and you work out what is the nub of the case. And the nub of the case takes us back to really two simple issues, both binary. Is it justiciable or non-justiciable? Can we as a court express a view on this matter at all? If we can't, that's it. It's lawful. If it is justiciable, if we can express a view on it, was the decision lawful on the merits, on the substance of the decision?
I read that on the first day, a live stream of the hearing was accessed 4.4 million times. Constitutional law doesn't often make primetime viewing. Philippe, you must have been in your element.
I think the reason that it attracts interest is because around the world, and I think a lot of the viewers were from outside the United Kingdom, the United Kingdom has a reputation as the sort of the rule of law country, the place in which judicial independence is at its peak, where respect for the judiciary, the independence of the judiciary, is like nowhere else in the world. And people understood, I think, that what was at issue here in the context of a government that appears mildly out of control in terms of the excesses it's willing to engage in, an absolutely fundamental question: does the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom have the power to stop Parliament from meeting? It doesn't get bigger than that. It's as simple as that.
Doesn't get any more dramatic than this.
Good evening. We start with the landmark case being heard at the Supreme Court as the constitutional conflict provoked by the Brexit crisis reaches the highest court in the UK.
Our case is that when the Prime Minister exercises his admittedly broad discretionary power to advise Her Majesty on prorogation, it is an improper purpose for him to be motivated by a wish to avoid parliamentary control over the policies of his government.
The moment when I really understood, and others really understood, that potentially something very significant was going to happen was right at the end on day three, when a lot of questions were asked about what remedies, assuming they find it's justiciable, assuming they find it's unlawful, what happens next?
So However, of course, Parliament needs to have, in your scenario, it needs to have the opportunity.
It does.
To do that.
It does.
So it would need to meet as soon as possible in order to decide what it's going to do next.
Exactly.
Judges don't spend time asking about their remedies and what should happen if they haven't moved very far along on the decision-making process. And I think for a lot of people, that was the moment where they thought,
At 10:30 yesterday morning, the judgment was handed down by Lady Hale. We should just say briefly, Lady Hale has kind of captured a lot of imagination. She's the president of the Supreme Court. What do you make of her?
Lady Hale is the first ever female president of the Supreme Court. She is a completely independent person, someone who does not come with a privileged background to that position, someone who has completely worked herself up the judicial ladder through the quality of her work, and has got to the pinnacle. She is someone I trust completely to exercise independent judgment. If she had thought the case should go the other way, she would have gone the other way. This is not a case at all in which politics intrudes. Now, she has a tough role as president because she has to marshal 10 other judges who are sitting with her. The single most striking feature of this judgment, from my perspective, is that it was unanimous on a hugely complex and important issue.
Because of the importance of the case, we convened a panel of 11 justices, the maximum number of serving justices who are permitted to sit. This judgment is the unanimous judgment of all 11 justices.
Why do I think that's significant? Because it signals that the judges knew themselves that their institution was going to be under scrutiny, and they wanted to do everything they could, quite rightly in my view, to protect that institution. And the way you protect that institution is by speaking with a single voice. And the fact that Brenda Hale was able to achieve that is remarkable.
And yesterday, when the verdict or the judgment was read out and all eyes were turned to news channels, what was your reaction? Where were you, and what was your reaction to the decision?
So at 10:15, I was leaving the gym, and I rushed home, switched on my laptop, went onto the news channel, and watched from the very first moment.
Okay, let's interrupt the sports news there. Sorry about that, John. We're going to cross straight over to the Supreme Court and get the ruling from Baroness Hale.
And one of the things that I loved about the way that it was done was there was none of this stringing it out for 20 minutes. And I think it's part of Lady Hale's judicial style. Straight to the point, within a minute and a half.
We have before us two appeals. One from the High Court of England and Wales, and one from the inner house of the Court of Session in Scotland.
She said it's justiciable. That's it. Now let's get on to the substance. And what I really liked about it was that, you know, lawyers are very often criticised rightly for using arcane, inaccessible language. She presented a statement which she will have written, which could be understood by a reasonable, intelligent human being who had no background in the law. She told a story, and she used some lines which I thought were very, very striking. She said,
"The effect on the fundamentals of our democracy was extreme."
And I'm quoting, "The effect upon the fundamentals of our democracy was extreme." She's talking about prorogation at this particular moment in time. And those words, "the effect upon the fundamentals of our democracy was extreme," are immensely powerful. The important point of this judgment is not that it says the Prime Minister misled the Queen. The judgment doesn't say that. This judgment is premised on the idea that Parliament was frustrated in its role. It could not carry out its ability to legislate, to see through legislation that was working its way through Parliament because of a decision taken without justification. Not only have you given inadequate justification, you've given no justification. In other words, it is pure politics. It's a devastating judgment, and that's why people are saying he's got to consider his position.
And Philippe, why is this so historically significant, this decision?
The decision is so historically significant because it is the apex of the question of allocation of powers between different arms of the governance of this country. The courts have spoken and said that ultimately Parliament is the beating heart of the democracy and the constitution of the United Kingdom, and Parliament can only be silenced in exceptional circumstances. And this is not an exceptional circumstance.
But could Boris Johnson now prorogue again?
Well, let me answer you. I think it was a good idea to have... I'll see what the justices say.
So you might do it again. Say.
Well, if he prorogues again, he'll go straight back to the courts, and the courts will come
again.
Except now we know what the court's reasoning will be, so he has to find a justification. And it has to be a justification good enough to allow the effects upon the fundamentals of our democracy to be explained away by something that's even more important. Frankly, I can't imagine what is more important. I mean, you're dealing with situations of war and these kinds of things, but what can he actually say? And he can't just do it on his own. He's got to go to his Attorney General. I know the Attorney General. I know Geoffrey Cox. He's a very decent person, a very decent lawyer, a very honourable person. Geoffrey Cox has got the judgment. Geoffrey Cox will read the judgment. And Geoffrey Cox will say, or ought to say to him, Prime Minister, I'm terribly sorry. We've now got the approach taken by the court. Frankly, if you're going to prorogue again, I'm out. I think if I was Attorney General, having given advice, if I gave advice that allowed this to happen, I'd really be thinking that the honourable thing to do in all of the circumstances is to step down.
And you think that his position is in question because of the advice he gave?
Well, I think he's a really decent person and I trust him. And I don't know what advice he gave. You know, the role of an Attorney General is to give the Prime Minister advice, and the Prime Minister can then take it or leave it. It's, you know, it's not dispositive.
I mean, do you worry ultimately within our constitution, where the rule of law is a cornerstone of our whole society, this judgment has to be respected. But we've seen before, in, you know, certainly from areas of the media and from politicians, a lack of respect, certainly for judges. I mean, Boris Johnson said yesterday in his response to the verdict that there are some people who are trying to frustrate the Brexit process. Do you worry that this tone could erode those foundational principles of our democracy?
There's politics. People are free to try to stop Brexit from happening. They're free to try to make it happen sooner. I think those are political matters. What's of greater concern, putting this in a broader context, is we have a Prime Minister who was willing to say just a few days ago, I can imagine not complying with an Act of Parliament. I can imagine breaking the law. I have never heard that before. And the moment you have a Prime Minister who is willing to countenance that possibility, you are in a very different place. And I think what a lot of people are extremely concerned about is we have as Prime Minister, an individual who we know, I know from having worked with him on the opposite side of him, having known him for 30 years, pays no attention to detail, does no preparation, blabbers whatever comes into his head at a particular moment, does it sometimes with humour, sometimes with style, sometimes he's genial, sometimes he's not, but there's no preparation. When he was Foreign Secretary, he would be given briefing papers, he wouldn't read them, and he would just blabber on and say whatever came into his head. That may be fine if you're Mayor of London. I happen to think it's not. It may be fine if you're a husband. I think it's not. It may be fine if you're just an ordinary citizen. He's Prime Minister. You can't have a Prime Minister saying, well, you know, if I don't like the Act of Parliament, it doesn't suit me, I might not comply with it. You just cannot have that situation. But we have that situation. What this judgment does, the reason I think it is so significant in the long term, is it draws a line and it says, no one is above the law. Not even a Prime Minister of this country.
Philippe, thank you very much.
Real pleasure to be with you.
Keep up to date with all the latest from Westminster with our excellent political team at theguardian.com. Coming up, our democracy is under attack from tech companies and we need to fight back.
The way things are isn't the way they have to be.
But knowing what to challenge and how to change it isn't always clear.
That's why independent journalism has never mattered more.
When we are free to follow any lead
and question any authority,
we can confront the status quo,
uncover vital alternatives,
and bring clarity to the world's most complex issues.
We can help our readers understand the world.
So together we can fight for a better one. Hope is power.
And with your support,
you'll always find it
at The Guardian.
Now, Shoshana Zuboff is a leading academic based at Harvard Business School. Her groundbreaking new book shines a light on a new era of capitalism, surveillance capitalism. She argues that tech giants turn our private online experience into profitable data, and that now is the time to resist this attack on democracy before it's too late.
the first thing that we have to start doing is educating ourselves. We need to create a new public conversation that reawakens our sense of outrage. Every time the surveillance capitalists have crossed a new threshold, the world exploded in outrage. When Google Gmail came on stream in 2004 and people discovered that its machines were scanning our emails for targeted advertising, you know, the whole world exploded in outrage. This was considered absolutely unbearable. And then look what happened. We habituate. We get numb. I call that psychic numbing. And we lose that sense of outrage. And then Street View began, and they're taking pictures of our homes and our streets and our neighborhoods and our cities. And the world once again exploded in outrage, thousands of lawsuits all over the world. But look how we've habituated to that. Over the years, they've worn us down, and we've lost our moral bearings. We've lost that sense of our righteous boundaries. Now is the time to reawaken outrage, because the water is rising, friends. And it began with maybe the more trivial things of targeted ads, but now it's moving into every domain of the economy and every domain of our lives. So we begin with a sea change in our own willingness to say no. This is not okay. We should not be talking about how we hide in our own lives, how we talk about encryption and camouflage. Instead, we have to band together. We have to create these new conversations, create new groups, create new demands, and really insist that our elected officials face down these issues. And it's the next 5 and 10 years that are going to be critical in this work, as we demand of our democracy that our governments, our democratic institutions, reassert control over the digital future and demand that the digital future is one that is compatible with democracy and compatible with our true needs. It should be solving disease, solving climate, and not trivializing our needs in these silly forms of targeted advertising and personalization that sort of buy us off in the short term but are meaningless in the long term. That is the big collective challenge that faces us now. And it's a work that I believe has already begun. It's a work that is growing around the world. And I believe it's a work that we will be successful in over the coming years.
That was Shoshana Zuboff. Thanks to her, Peter Walker and Philippe Sands. Today's episode was produced by Mithili Rao, Joshua Kelly and Gary Marshall. Sound design was by Ivan Manley, and the executive producers were Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.